Good evening. Greetings in Jesus' name this evening. As Murray read to us, applying biblical principles to social media and internet is my assignment tonight. So for starters, let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. I want to read just a couple verses here as an introduction to this subject. As we think about media and the generation in which we live, and the tremendous opportunity that it affords us, as well as the risk here. Apostle Paul is talking to the Corinthians here in verse 5. "Now I will come unto you when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia, and it may be that I will abide, yea, and winter with you, that you may bring me on my journey whithersoever I go. For I will not see you now by the way, but I trust to tarry a while with you, if the Lord permit. But I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. For a great door and effectual is open unto me, and there are many adversaries." I read this verse some time ago, and I thought about the issue of media in our generation. He says here that he's going to abide at Ephesus because he sees a great door of opportunity, and it's powerful, but notice the last verse. The last of the verse, it says, "and there are many adversaries." Apostle Paul understood that here was potential. Here was an opportunity for him to reach people. But with this opportunity, even though it was powerful, it came with the adversaries. And that's us today as we look at media in our generation. It's a powerful opportunity for us. And yet, it has adversaries. The adversaries come along with the opportunity. You know, and that's the way technology has been for years and years. We often laud the invention of the printing press. And yet, you know, when the printing press was invented, soon after, it afforded an opportunity for a great business of pornography soon after the printing press was invented because of that invention. We look at that invention and we say, you know, this is powerful for the Word of God. And yet at the same time, it gave opportunity for the adversary. Let's turn to John chapter 17. As we look at this subject tonight, I'm going to be talking a lot about my journey with media and studying media. I have a lot to learn. I don't have all the answers. I'm going to share with you what I've learned from a lot of other people and research that I have done on my own because it interests me and I see it as a potential threat in my life. And yet it's also a potential opportunity that I can use. And I think it's a journey that we all need to take in some way or another if we're going to be a part of this generation that uses media in the way we do. And I want to give credit tonight for men that have helped me and taught me a lot in my journey with media, Harry Argo being one of them. I've learned a lot from Brother Harry, and I appreciate everything that he has taught me. He studied media for 20 years, and I feel like I've almost cheated to be able to sit under his teaching and learn from him because he spent so many years gathering information, and then in a short time I can take this. And people like Jim Petrosky and other faithful men, I appreciate tonight that I can take that knowledge and apply it to my life, and I want to share it with you tonight. Let's start here reading at verse 14 of John chapter 17. We're breaking in here to Jesus' prayer. He's praying for the disciples. Start reading at verse 14. "I have given them thy word, and the world hated them. The world hath hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. As thou hast sent me into the world, even so have I also sent them into the world. And for their sakes I sanctify myself, that they also might be sanctified through truth. Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I in them, and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved me as thou hast loved me." Here as we look at Jesus praying for his disciples, he's asking God to keep them through his power, through truth. He says, sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. You know, and as soon as he talks about this, he immediately launches into the relationships of the disciples. As soon as he talks about sanctification through truth, he starts talking about relationships. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. And then Jesus prays for us in our generation with in media culture. It says here, for all those who will believe. All those who are coming after you are going to have this same type of relationships that are going to face battles. Jesus was praying for you and I. And he said, keep them. You know, notice about this prayer that Jesus didn't pray that he would, that God would raise us up somehow out of this evil culture to a plateau of perfection, but he said, keep them from evil. He didn't say, take them out of the world. He said, keep them from the evil. You know, it is possible in media culture to have these kinds of relationships that Jesus is talking about. A relationship with Jesus Christ, myself with God, and also a relationship with one another. And I think that that is pertinent in our generation as we look at media. Fighting this battle of media, I believe it is imperative that we maintain brotherhood relationships. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. You know, Jesus wouldn't have prayed this if it wouldn't have been possible. Back in the 1800s, during the Victorian culture started in the early 1800s and went to the early 1900s. It's named after Queen Victoria of Britain. But when you see these black and white photos, these portraits hanging around in museums and different places of this real stern-looking person in black and white, and they're dressed like William Penn or somebody like that, it probably represents someone in the Victorian era, in the Victorian culture. And this culture was known for its straight-laced language and public behavior. You know, some of the defining qualities of Victorian culture were low tolerance for crime. The culture was known for its sexual restraint and strict social code of conduct, at least in public. These were earmarks of the Victorian era in the Victorian culture. It was not necessarily a Christian culture, in that there was a lot of things that weren't Christian. And we talked about prejudice and being racist. We've heard about that. And those things were prevalent in the Victorian era. But the social code of conduct was a very strict behavior. The acceptable code of conduct was something that you and I could identify with today as Mennonites. But you know, as this culture came into the 1900s and early 1900s, with the invention of media, when the movie industry was cranked up in full-fledged with Hollywood and the invention of the television, that was a medium that introduced a liberal thought that was the demise of the Victorian era. And it was the beginning of popular culture that we live in today, the popular culture of liberal thought. So Victorian culture was taken over by popular culture, and we see that popular culture today as we live. We look at it as rampant around as it's developed to stages way beyond what probably even the people in the early 1900s thought it would. But the movie industry and television, this technology, it lengthened the reach of liberal thought, people from Hollywood, and those who wanted to influence the minds of blue-collar Americans. And by having television, and by having these movie theaters, and they had these old ancient drive-up movies and different things that was developed, it gave a median for this liberal thought to put in philosophy into these movie pictures, and it got into the homes of the American people. This culture, this popular culture that we live in today, has been heavily influenced by mass media, television, music, movie industry, fashion, and clothes, that has changed the ideals of mainstream American people into what we have today. And it continues. I don't know where it's going to stop. But media had a big part to play in that change from the Victorian era into the culture that we see today. You know, there was many religious groups that opposed what they saw coming through the television era. There at the beginning of television, the beginning of the movie industry, they opposed that. They tried to stop it. But this liberal thought won out, and they won the battle. And eventually the movies became more and more corrupt, even though they pushed back. There was a lot of religious entities that tried to push back on the content of television and movie, and yet they lost the fight. You know, technology, media technology, has changed the mindset of our country. Liberal thought and ideas are growing and influencing many points of the culture that we live around today. It's changed the political character. It's changed retailers and the consumer market, the appetites that people go after. There's an appetite, and so retailers reach out to fill that appetite. And as they fill it, they develop it, and consumers respond. And this culture continues to become more and more liberal. And all the while, as the culture becomes more liberal, the content of media continues to degress into something that is more and more open, more and more shameful. This market has developed media tools with characteristics of modern thought. The things that we use, the devices that are in your pocket, the things you use in your office, was designed mostly by a modern popular culture. They weren't designed for Mennonites. They were designed for popular culture. And the church today, you're taking that device and you're trying to turn it into something useful. You're trying to make it something productive. And that's the challenge that we face as Christians. You know, sad to say, this culture that is earmarked for independence, it has an earmark for defying authority, for doing what they want to do, to become their own entity, to represent what they decide is right. There's not really any moral strings, but it's about deciding what I want. And that's the earmarks of popular culture. And it has influenced the church today that we live in. So thinking about this change that media has developed in our culture, as we think about the change that came through media, now let's think about our church culture as conservative Christians in our country. We think about internet and media, and we back that up with principles that we know exist. And what the development of television and the movie industry has done to culture, now I think it's important that we take that and look at what is it doing to us today. I think all of us here would say that we deeply appreciate the stand that the church has taken on television and radio, especially here as a group. I think I know most of us, and I could take a vote and it would probably be unanimous that we all appreciate the stand that the church took on television and radio. From 1943 to about 1960 was the years when conference was taking a stand on television. The issue of television came up, and the churches that took a stand on television, they were men of principle, and they saw what was happening in the industry. They saw what was happening in culture. And they said, now wait a minute. We don't want this coming into our churches. We don't want this media reaching into our homes and changing our culture, changing our values and our beliefs. The most important thing is they did something about it. Now we look at television and we say, well, it's very obvious that was the right thing to do. But you know, back when that happened, it wasn't an easy application to make to bad content. In 1958, the Lancaster Conference had problems with families violating this stand, and they had television in their homes in spite of the fact that the church had taken a stand on television. And so finally, the leadership got up in front of church, in front of the congregation, and they had a list that they read off of the families that weren't complying with this application. And my understanding is, as they read this list off and they named the families, these families got up and walked out of church because they weren't willing to adhere to the application that the church had made. Now, sad to say that in the early 60s, I believe, a lot of the conference churches, they backed up on that application and they started to allow television. There was a lot of thought in conference that we'll take this media and we'll use it for good. We'll use it for witnessing. We'll put good stations out there that will reach people and be a witness. But they lost the battle. As the television stations continued to advance, the entertainment got more and more appealing. The viewers got less and less on the good stations, and they switched to stations that weren't so good until they didn't have viewers. And it got more and more expensive to put data and content on television, and they finally gave up. They actually had media committees, from what I've read, and these media committees were in charge of trying to use this media as a way to witness. to the unbelievers. But it wasn't too long and it phased out. They lost the battle, and the church in general lost the battle. It wasn't long until television was mainstream with those churches just like society. But as we look at that stand that the church took on television and television content, I believe that they saw the principle of moderating the environment in which we have control of, and that's in our homes and in our churches, in our schools. They saw the need to make sure that they were in control of the content that came to their children. Now, they, obviously, by saying no to television, they didn't moderate all the content of television at every place they would ever go. But they saw the need to regulate it in their homes where it was pertinent, where the most influence was going to come to them. And I believe that application of no television was the most effective in the home. It had far-reaching effects. And tonight, we're only going to touch on the basic principles because we don't have the time to develop into a lot of things that these things reach out into. But not allowing this content to come into the home created a barrier. It kept the parents and the churches in control of the things and the influences, the entertainment. They didn't want the world to entertain their children. They wanted to be in charge of entertainment. They wanted to be in charge of the content that was coming and teaching their youth and their small children and even the parents. You know, when radio and television came into the blue-collar families of the American society, that the evening activities changed in homes. Instead of doing things together, they would sit around the living room and watch television. They would sit around and listen to the radio. And there was a big change in activity. It actually had a functional change effect on the families of our American culture at that time. Because now, all of a sudden, these families who maybe couldn't afford to go out and have all this fine dining and great entertainment, it could bring it right into their home. And they'd sit around as a family and watch television. They were mediated. They were building this relationship with this media, and it changed the mindset. You know, today, we have a keen awareness of television content. We understand, without having television, the danger of the content on television. But, you know, our generation is faced with maintaining those same principles of content, entertainment, and education in the media culture in which we live. And in a lot of ways, it's a lot more complex. You know, back in the 1940s and 50s, the church took the stand of, let's stay out of the water because the water is evil. And it served us well. If the church had decided to leave that decision up to individual families, where do you think we would be today? If they hadn't collaborated on this principle and decided that, look, we need to take a collective stand on television to ward out this content that is coming, where would we be today? I don't think that we would be experiencing the blessing that we have today if the church hadn't collectively made a decision on some of this content. But you know, back then, television was only a slice of the pie. It wasn't the all-conclusive part of our life, part of their life, like media is today for us. You know, the way our economic and informational society is set up, there's really no way for us to get around exposure to media and media content. It's not only a slice of the pie anymore. It includes almost 100% of the pie. In some way or another, we're going to be exposed to media content. But the principle still exists for us as it did in the 1950s for our forefathers. Are we going to maintain this principle through the complex media generation in which we live? Can and will we maintain this principle? I believe it is possible, but we must first of all understand the principle. We heard today that we don't know where we're going unless we know where we came from. And I think that's important as we look at media. If we're just going to look at media right here, what's in front of me, what's blaring me in the face, if I'm just going to look at that and try to make a wise decision, I'm not going to come out where I need to come out. But if I can look back and understand where we came from and where this is taking us, why am I here? Because a lot of the blessings that I experience in a clean environment, a Christian environment that I grew up in and that I promote, a lot of those decisions I didn't need to make on my own. And a lot of you here today didn't have much to do with those decisions. You're a beneficiary of the decisions made before your time. Do you understand the principles that those decisions were based on? And are you willing to see that and line it up with the actions that you're doing today, that you're making, the decisions you're making to make sure that you're headed in the direction you want to go? So this first the first principle is controlling the content. I think content is critical. It's not really about glass and plastic. It's not really about the device. Even though the device is a medium that brings me content, the content really is what finally makes or breaks the principle. Number two, our environment. We need to make sure that the principle of controlled environment, protected environment, as we choose tools and as we use those tools for content and information, we need to make sure that the principle is upheld. The principle of no television was staying away, keeping a distance between this liberal thought that was coming into culture, this liberal entertainment that was entering into society, and that was a barrier that protected a principle. And if we're not going to apply, then we're not going to keep the principle. Number three, a good stewardship of time. You know, is popular culture dictating what your family is spending their time in entertainment? The culture that we live in today, what influence does that have on how you spend your time, how you entertain yourself, how you allow your children to entertain themselves? And then, what is the source of the content? And, you know, I came to realize for myself that content is important, but the source of the content is also important. When we look at the source of information, that source that we draw information from is going to influence us in some way. If somebody is moderating a source of information, if they have a website or they have some kind of a media aspect out here, and you're going to draw from that, you are going to be influenced by their mindset because they are the ones that decide what kind of media you're going to view if you go to their source. And that will influence you. And so the source of the content is very important as we look at information. As we take part in media, I think we need to be aware of the source. When we think about the source and influence, our minds are created to be influenced by other minds. I wasn't born with a complete mindset of some kind, but God made my mind, He made your mind, your brain, to be influenced by other people. And so you're going to have to choose in your lifetime what you're going to allow to influence you. And media is a tremendous influence. Just the median that is there through media, your mind is extremely susceptible to that information. And so you're going to have to decide what is going to influence my mind. And we could go into that some more, but we don't have time. But our minds are influenced by other minds. What influences my mind? What do I choose to allow to change and alter the mindset that I have in life through media? It's going to be my choice. You know, if we're going to maintain these principles based on decisions like, well, what is it going to cost me? Or what am I going to have to give up? Or let's just ignore it and hope it goes away. Or I'll throw out the device and try to eliminate the issue. You know, that premise is not going to work. Ignorance is not bliss, and the device is not immoral. But when we pick up that device, right away the way we use that device determines whether it is immoral or all moral, or moral. As we strengthen these principles, as the decisions that I am making personally, and the decisions that we are making as a church, is it really building on the principles that have been handed down to us from another generation? You know, we say we appreciate our stand on television, but does our decisions on media really bear that out? And I think this subject of media gets so large, sometimes we can hardly see both edges at the same time, and it overwhelms us. And we know in math, sometimes we take a big fraction and we reduce it down, and it helps us to understand really the content or the value of the fraction. And I'm going to do that for you tonight. And this is only an example of what I think we need to do in our decisions of media. You know, think about it. What's 5,000 over 20,000? It's the same as 1/4, right? But we can comprehend 1/4 much easier than we can think through. It doesn't take too long. But we have to stop and think about 5,000 over 20,000. So I'm going to do that tonight. As we think about the principles that we say we value, think about this. What if I would come to your church And I would propose to you as a congregation that you would allow the radio. But along with my recommendation, I would also recommend that you only allow one station on that radio, because we know that there's a lot of bad content. But there is one or two stations in your area, and we would pick those out carefully. And then we would say, well, let's vote on the radio based on that we will encourage people just to use this one station. What do you think the vote would be in your congregation, the outcome of that vote? Or what about this? If I would come to your church and I would propose that you introduce television to your people. Because there's one station that you can access in your area that is relatively good. It only has a few commercials every once in a while that aren't healthy and maybe some bad content everywhere. But we would advise your membership that when this comes up, that you would just change stations or shut it off for 15 or 20 minutes and then go back on to the good station. What do you think the outcome of that vote would be? I don't think we have to think about it too long. I think I know where you would arrive, and it would probably be without too much thought. But you know, as we think about internet and the applications that we exercise on the internet, do we sometimes do the same thing? Take, for instance, YouTube and news sites. You know, we go to a source. Remember, the source matters. We go to the source of information, and we know that YouTube, for instance, is made up of mostly bad content. The source of that content is relatively evil. Most of that is put on there is unchristian, it's unwholesome. But it has a sliver over here that is somewhat instructional. And I see the Anabaptist churches as a whole, not everyone, and there's a lot that don't, but a lot of us have acclimated to these sources, and we're kind of doing the same thing, aren't we? We recognize it's evil, we recognize it's put together by evil people, but there's a few things I'd like to access because it's not too bad. What about listening to a cappella gospel music on YouTube? We say, well, it's cheaper, and I don't have to go buy it. And after all, the content is the same, right? If I listen to a song by the Garment of Praise on YouTube, or if I go and purchase a CD, it's just $15 difference. The song is the same. The source of our information does have an influence. I believe in here at Seymour, you have a video store named the Video Vault. So say there was, beside this store, there was a Christian bookstore sitting right next to it. And there was Christian music, a cappella gospel music that your church approved of in that Christian store. And then your son or your daughter would come to you and say, now, I want to go to Seymour and get some more music. Where would you encourage them to go? To the Video Vault or to the Christian bookstore? Because over here in this Video Vault, say they had one rack of Christian music, and you knew that. I probably left that out at the beginning. One rack of Christian music. The rest of the store was filled with the filth of video stores. And on that rack, there was a CD that your son wanted. But over here in the Christian bookstore, there was also CDs. Where would you tell your children to go to buy their music? Are we doing that with source and content on the internet? You know, I'm not here to make blanket statements and to say something is completely wrong or completely right. I'm really throwing this out to make you think about how you use media. If you do research on the young viewers of our society today, I think you will find that a lot of our young people in society are leaving traditional television and they're migrating towards spending their time watching video clip sites like Netflix and YouTube and places like that. They're going away from the traditional television that grandpa likes to sit in the evening and watch. And they spend more time over here watching video clip sites. So we have this shift in society, this television society that is leaving traditional television and they're migrating towards these sites for entertainment. And then over here, you have the church that is non-television, correct? And we wouldn't boast about it, but we're not scared to say, no, we don't have television. And yet, We've come from the application of stay out of the water to now we're in the water and we're trying to swim. And I see a lot of people who are starting to allow, what? These video clip sites like YouTube and other Vimeo and different things like that. We're starting to spend our time. And so you have the church that is starting to make exceptions for that one rack in the video store, and they're moving this way, and then you have a culture that's television culture, and they're moving away from traditional television, and they're moving towards what? They're moving towards YouTube and Vimeo and Netflix and things like that. That's where they're spending their time. I think the major television outlets and YouTube are having a debate right now about who has the most viewers. And it's YouTube is fast taking over the time of our younger generation in our society. So pretty soon, where are we going to be? We have a non-television church, and we have a television culture, and they're going to meet in the middle. And we say, well, I'm spending my time on instructional things at YouTube, and they're spending their time on corrupt entertainment. But how long is it going to be until I acclimate to the source, and there's not going to be very much difference in the content that I observe and I allow in my home that has been protected for generations, and my neighbor's home who allows his young people to spend time on YouTube instead of television. You know, when it comes down to it, it's television content. Are we violating the principle of controlled content and influence that has been guarded and preserved for 50 years before we came on the scene? Or maybe before I came on the scene as a mature adult. Some of you may remember those times. Think about this. If you like to read, I'm 42 years old, something like that, and I like to read. I enjoy reading articles, and I would rather go on a source on the internet most of the time, and I want to read what I want to read. But, you know, if I'm going to places like Fox News and CNN and CBS and places like that, and I'm going to their source and I'm reading these articles. Well, it's just an article, right? It's kind of like in the newspaper. But my children are standing by, and this started to happen in my home. As I like to read these articles, I started going to these sources, and pretty soon I saw what was happening, that I would read the article, and my children like to watch the video clips. And so if that continues to happen, I'm on this source of television, Fox News, and I'm reading this article. Pretty soon my children are watching the video clips, and then pretty soon the election rolls around. And so we watch breaking news, and we watch on election night, we watch the results of the election come in. How long is it going to be until we do what? Buy television? No, we wouldn't buy a television. But how long is it going to be until breaking news is playing over my laptop every morning or afternoon or evening? When we've done that, we've arrived at television. We don't have a television, but the content is the same. We've acclimated to the source, and it's not going to take very long. You know, if this happens, it will not only change our reality and influence our sense of morality, but it will rob us of relationships. It will change us from a brotherhood culture to a pop culture just like we see around us. Maybe not as steep, maybe not as vile, but it's going to come. This application of stay out of the water that has been served us so well as Mennonite and Anabaptist churches, I believe that the downside to this strong application, you know, every good point has its weakness. And I believe that as we look at stay out of the water, that we have, most of us that is my age and some younger, we've been raised in a media world where we pretty much have stayed out of the water. But now, in a large portion of our churches, we've decided that the water is getting so deep, we're in the water. But you know, the downside, I believe, to this application is that our churches are adept at drawing lines on devices. We're good at saying that don't have this device, and yes, you can have this. But we're still in the infant stage of drawing lines on content and uses within that device. That's the weakness that we have, that my generation has. And I think that as we look at that, we're changing our application, we're shifting, hopefully to maintain principle. But our weakness is that we're not very good at drawing lines on content. I'll give you a primitive example of that. And I'm not saying that this example is wrong. I'm just using this as something that's clear and short. A lot of us, I grew up in a church that didn't allow video. They didn't allow video cameras. We didn't have VCRs, right? They weren't allowed. As a church, we agreed not to have VCRs and video cameras. But we had still cameras. We had cameras that we could shoot still pictures with. Well, after the digital world integrated into our society and we started buying these digital cameras, and that was okay because we're shooting digital still pictures, right? Well, pretty soon the video capability came along with the still picture capability on a device that was already approved. And what happened? Now, I'm not here to condemn that. I'm just using that as an example of what can happen, I believe, in our culture when we have grown up with a stay-out-of-the-water concept, and now we're in the water and we're learning to swim, which I think is the right thing to do. But these are the dangers that we need to understand right off the bat that we probably have a weakness in defining content. Change has been traditionally thought of in our culture as liberal. A lot of times when we saw change, it meant that there was a shift towards something more progressive, that there was a losing of a principle. And I think that's another thing that we need to overcome in the media culture. We need to understand that the principle must stay the same, but it's going to take changes. We're not going to be able to just draw one simple line and then just ride on that for 10 years. It's not going to work. We're going to miss the mark. But rather, it's going to take change to stay current to preserve the principle. And we're going to have to understand it's a shift in our thinking. As we think about change, oftentimes we think about it's progressive. It's a shift to losing something. But in the media culture, we're going to have to adapt to the thought that change must be there for our applications to stay current. And that's not comfortable for 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds. We would like to just set the course, and we're already kind of uncomfortable with the whole media elephant, and then we have to continually look at it. It's not real comfortable. But we must be willing to change our application. We're relatively new at defining media content. We need to be aware. I think we've spent the last 10 to 15 years trying to moderate content on internet browsers, for example. You know, for the last 10 years, the church has worked hard to try to find some kind of safeguards to put in place to moderate the internet browsers that we use. Now we've kind of got that under control. But I think that right now we're facing in our culture that the browser is somewhat controlled. But now the apps and applications that come on our portable devices are the danger zone that we're facing today. And I ask you, I ask myself, am I keeping up with the aspect of controlled content on apps? You know, apps are the fast, cheap, and easy way to access what I want to access. And the retailers of these devices understand that. They know if they can make it fast, cheap, and easy, that they will keep the crowd going where they want to go. And so a lot of these businesses, a lot of these websites have created this app. Why? They didn't do that for you. They did that for them. Because they want to keep you in their zone. They want to channel you in the direction that they want you to go. They don't want you to leave. And so these apps are creating browsers. They're creating access to the internet through a lot of the apps. And unfortunately, a bunch of these apps we're using as Anabaptist people. Do you know where these apps will take you? You know, the apps are really the back door into a lot of places. And they're a lot more dangerous than a browser. And 10 years ago, we were faced with the challenge of, how can I moderate this browser? Now, I look at it, we have the browser under control, but the apps aren't under control. And if we lose the content in an app, it's no better than not guarding the browser. So I challenge you, as you use these devices, are you going to be controlled by these developers who are basically secular, by principles like fast, cheap, and easy? If you're going to do that, you're probably going to end up places you don't want to go. Social media. We don't have a lot of time to address this, but I want to look at maybe a nuts and bolts issue of social media. We've already established the importance of relationships for us as Christians. We've talked about relationships with Christ in John 17 and the relationships with each other. And the relationship that I have with Christ is my purpose here on earth. And that relationship with Jesus Christ is going to extend to my brethren. And that's what my purpose, that's the start and stop of my purpose. There's a lot of other things that are within the confines of my life, but my sole purpose is my relationship with God and my relationship with other people. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 22. I don't want to keep you a long time, so we're going to move through this pretty quickly. Matthew chapter 22, verse 36 through 40. Here's Jesus talking to the lawyer. Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said unto him, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Here Jesus is explaining this very principle of relationships, that we love the Lord our God with all our soul, heart, and mind. That's relationship. And as we have this relationship, it extends to our brethren and people around us. And those relationships are so critical to our brotherhood experience, and especially as we deal with media. You know, if we study concepts of the brotherhood in the New Testament, it breeds relationships. Without relationships, there would be no church. Mark Zuckerberg, who is the CEO of Facebook, he recently took a trip around the United States to visit churches. And as he visited these evangelical pastors, he wanted to find out what made community in these churches. As he observed, he's not a religious man. In fact, he's a very liberal man. But he saw in these churches an element of community that he wanted to integrate in his social media platform, because he wants to take the world, he wants to globalize the people who access his social media platform, and he wants to create this globalization of community. Why? Because he wants to integrate his ideas and things he thinks are important. And he wants to create this close feel community on through his website and through his influence. What Mark Zuckerberg doesn't understand is that community in our brotherhood is not an end in itself. It's a result of something much deeper. Without a relationship with Jesus Christ, there would be no community like we know it today. You know, he wants to globalize this community. He wants to make this huge ball that includes a lot of people from a lot of different races and a lot of beliefs. And he wants to integrate this and make community out of it. He wants to make what you and I experience on an everyday basis, because we're a part of a brotherhood that feels that relationship of community. It's not going to work. Brotherhood relationships is not integrated ideas. It's men and women who are sanctified by truth, and who to come together because of conviction for truth and the principles that are lived out in our life as a shared people, it creates community. You know, through that, the brotherhood is formed. It's formed around godly values, not about integrated ideas. Not integrating all our ideas to commit to tolerance, where I'll put up with what you want to do and you put up with what I want to do and we'll have this real feel. It's not going to work. You know, there was recently an online conversation. It was kind of a blog forum of men who discussed what is really involved in real community. And there was 4 points that they came up with in this discussion. Number one, they said real community must have shared history. It must have history that people have shared together. Number two, it must have permanence or a close proximity. We must be geographically close and tied together in a close way. Number four, it needs to have shared vision. If you look at a lot of social media and the relationship that it creates, it has none of these except maybe the last one, shared vision. And that's really, that vision can only go as far as saying, well, we agree that we're all going to the same place, whatever that is. You can't have shared history on a media platform. You can't have permanence. There's not a commitment to something, really, in the real world. A commitment where we build memories, where we live life together because we're committed. There's not a close proximity most of the time on a social platform. It's spread out over a geographically huge area. Shared vision. You know, if you look at all four of these and you break them down, all of these attributes are found in brotherhood principles and in brotherhood experience. Our need for relationship in our lives is similar to our need for food. You know, I get hungry. And so when I get hungry, what do? I want to eat. And then I need to make a choice of what I'm going to eat. I need to decide if I'm going to eat protein or if I'm going to eat Twinkies or if I'm going to eat candy bars or what. I need to decide how I'm going to satisfy that appetite and my hunger. And our need for relationship is much the same way. As humans, the way we're built, we need relationship. And so we're going to have to decide, how am I going to fill that bin of relationship? And I can spend my time filling myself up with Twinkies, and I'm not hungry for real relationships. And you know, there's a lot of connected relationships in instant messaging and social media that is kind of like eating Twinkies. Does it fill you up? Yeah, it fills you up. Is it protein? No, not very much. You know, social media and instant messaging, I believe there is some limited value in staying connected. As we look at tools and instant messaging, there's a tremendous coordination that goes on through instant messaging. I can text my coworker and say, you know, I'll be late, or how about this? We already share a relationship, and we're coordinating. We're passing information. It's a valuable tool for something like that. And social media maybe can serve as an outlet as well in limited cases where you need to share information, where you stay connected. But the danger is that there are a lot of people who are trading the world of staying connected with the value of real relationships. And then they have this false fulfillment of relationships. And it does something there to their emotions. And there's a lot of things that we could look at as we look at the addiction part of social media. Social media and instant messaging, when we get wrapped up in that world of staying connected, and I send out a message because I'm feeling kind of lonely, and as I await a response to whoever I'm sending a message out, when that message falls into my phone, and I hear that little ding-a-ling, or I see that somebody has liked something that I've put on social media, it releases dopamine in my mind, in my brain, just like as if you were addicted to alcohol, pornography, or drugs. And, you know, it doesn't mean that everybody is experiencing that, but that's the kind of environment that a lot of people are entering into, free will, into this world of staying connected, and they're sacrificing time and ability to build real relationships in their life. So as we look at the tool of staying connected, tools of instant messaging and whatever else, there's so many different ways that we communicate. We should be the best communicators that ever lived on the face of the earth, but we're not. But we can falsely fill our relational need with social media and instant communication, online media. We can even develop and fulfill our need for relationship just by the device and the interface that I want to play with. I can doodle around on this device and fill my relational needs. There's a lot of young people in our society who are doing just that. You can't hold a conversation with them. They don't want to talk to you. Why? Because they spent the last 2 hours on their phone mediating this relationship. And they don't really have a need. And it's proven that if you take that device away from that person for about a week, that he'll come around and talk to you because he's looking for relationship. If we're not careful, we'll trade the world of staying connected. I mean, we'll trade good, solid relationships and real community for the world of staying connected. You know, real community relationships take work. And if we're not careful, we don't really like hard work. And so it's easy for us to shy away from the hard work of real relationships, and we shift to the world of staying connected. Instead of spending time with real relationship face-to-face and the communication that I should do on a face-to-face basis with my brother, it's too easy to jump in the world of staying connected and send a message. Is it good? It has its good points. But can it be abused? Very quickly. You know, the world of staying connected is very demanding. It requires a lot from those who are involved, from me. It's easy for me to get caught up in this world of staying connected, and pretty soon I'm sacrificing real relationships. As we look at communication and the use of communication, it's valuable, it's necessary, it's pertinent, it's essential to good relationships in the church. And yet, the temptation is there for us, like no other generation, to compromise good communication for the communication that is just really should stay in the level of coordination. And if we do that, it erodes our purpose. Our relationship with God will be affected by the kinds of relationships that really won't build. Pretty soon I'll have this huge network of connected relationships, but I'll be missing an integral part that I need and that God knew I needed to live my Christian life. You know, there's a man that owned Gore-Tex clothing. He started out as a small family business, and he built this business up. And one day, he walked out on the manufacturing floor, and he met an employee who he didn't know. And that really bothered him. He went back into his office, and he sat down, and he started to consider, now, how did I go from a family business where I knew everybody to this point where I don't even know the employees that I pay? And so he kept backing up in time until he got down to about 150 people that was involved in his business. And at that point, he felt like at that point he still knew everybody in his business. He had a relationship with them. And about the time that he had this figured out, one of his good friends by the last name of Dunbar walked into his office, and this man was telling Dunbar about this, that, you know, I don't like it where I'm at right now. I don't know all of my employees, and I lost touch with them at about 150. And so Dunbar took this study up, and he did a study on this, and he found out that the average person is only capable of really developing, well, about 150 relationships, close relationships. And within that 150, you could split those up into the level of, you know, really, really close relationships and then moderately close. But it's interesting that when statistically most of us can only build a friendship level or a life of about 150 good, solid relationships, and yet so many people are trying to stay connected with 300, 500, and 600 people, and somehow they feel fulfilled in this, and it's not reality. It's a false reality of relationships. So the pressure is on in our generation to stay connected. Will we trade real relationships, real community, for the world of staying connected? You know, the world of staying connected has risks. Risk of losing relationship quality, risk of influence, risk of changing the appetite of our church culture to depending on media to fill my relational needs. Some points I want to think about that to consider as we navigate this path of media. I think it's important that we take time to be educated, to get educated in the world that we live in. You know, so many of us have shied away from things that we don't know or things that we're uncomfortable with, and we hope they work out. And it's not going to work out in our generation of media unless we get our feet in the water and we learn what's going on and so we can make educated decisions. Let's invest in the relationships that you value around you, your family, your church body, your friends. Invest in those relationships by educating yourself on what is going on around you. The thing that I think is pertinent, it's a must in our generation that we need to span the generation gap between the older ones and the younger ones if we're going to navigate this path of media. We need young people who are prophets. Young people are willing to define these things and use them in the right way. Use their techie talent in a way that is good for the church. And unless us as older ones, and I'm not old, I'm still young, but some of you who are older than me, my age group, and the younger ones, unless we span that relationship with a good, solid trust and communication, we're not going to navigate this swimming ability that we need in the day of media. We must use both the old and the young to come up with answers. You know, we need the input with experience of those who are experienced, of older ones, to come to the right conclusion. And we need the younger ones who are willing to step up and say, you know, I grew up in this and I see this and this, and I think this is where we should be. And there should be a trust level, a confidence level that we can work together, and we can couple experience and age with this vibrant education that our young people have. You know, recently I was talking to a man that was about my age about some of the threats that I see in our mobile use today, internet and apps. And as I was sitting there talking to this man, and this man is conscientious. He's trying hard, I believe, to find his way through for his family. But as I was talking to him about some of these things, and I said something that really surprised him. He didn't know. I said, you know, this threat is here. He didn't know it. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw his 16-year-old son sitting over here listening in. And what was he doing? He was nodding his head, agreeing with me. He already knew it. And Dad was just learning it. You know, are we going to tap into that resource of our younger generation to come up to power on our applications? You know, no one generation has all the answers. I have a quote here that says, "The error of the youth is to believe intelligence is a substitute for experience, while the error of the age is to believe that experience is a substitute for intelligence." We need to work together to develop our own platforms for good, consistent media. Let's encourage this techie talent that's around us. Let's put it to work. Let's build conviction in our young people so that we can depend on them to make good applications, to create safe pathways, to protect our environment, because we're in the water and we're going to have to learn to swim. And if it's just up to the old people, we're going to drown. We need the young people. You know, right now we're depending on a lot of technology for roadblocks, for technology that we really don't understand. We're borrowing it from other groups, other developers, and we're adapting it to protect integrity of a level that we want. But a lot of these groups that are developing this, they maybe want a level of protection, but maybe not the level we want. How much better would it be if our techie young people could develop something for us? If they could put this talent to work, educate themselves, and they could help us develop our own environment, help us to navigate this path safely, because not only because we're using something, but we've developed what we're using. I think that would be ideal. I have 3 points here that I gave to some young people recently that start with R. And it's very simple, but I think we need to remember. Number one, we need to remember the principle. Number two, we need to respond with application. You know, we can understand the principle, we can talk about it all day, but finally it comes down to, what am I doing that's really going to tell how effective that principle is going to be in my life? Then number three, after we've applied the principle, we need to refresh our knowledge. In media, it's so important that we refresh our knowledge. It's a huge ball. And so as we stand under this flow of media, it's hard for us to decide, you know, which direction I should turn. It's like standing under a huge waterfall, and the water's hitting me on the top of the head, and I'm trying to figure out where to take a drink. We're overwhelmed. But it's important that we remember the principle, respond with application, and refresh our knowledge. In conclusion, I want to tell a story that I love. I've told this story before, but I think it illustrates you and I in our generation. There was a rich farmer in the United States who took a trip to Haiti. He found out that he educated himself on the poverty that was in Haiti. And so on his own time and his own money, he flew over to Haiti, and he went into a village, and he bought this field. And then he went and bought equipment, excavating equipment, all the equipment he needed, and he built this big concrete fence around this field to protect it. Then he hired some local natives to come in and help him, and he cultivated this field, he worked it up, he fertilized it, and then he went out and he bought coconut seeds, and he planted these coconut seeds in nice, neat rows with the help of the natives. And I can't help but think, I don't know all the details of this story, and I don't even know for sure if it's true, but I heard it to be true. But I can't believe that a man like this wouldn't take the time to explain and educate these natives on what he was trying to do. He got these coconut seeds all planted in neat, nice rows, and his goal was to plant this, to use his resources to plant this field so that these natives who were living in poverty could enjoy the fruit of coconut trees for generation after generation. So after he got it all done, he donated the whole field to the local natives. He got back on the plane and he flew back to the United States. It wasn't long after he hit the ground in the United States that the natives, what did they do? They opened the gate, they went into the field, they dug up the seeds, and they ate them. Now, the farming ability in our culture would say that that's extremely foolish. But my question to us tonight is, what are we doing with the field that has been planted for our generation? You know, we've been given this prime opportunity. It's protected by this bulwark of brotherhood. It's a fertile field. It's been planted. The seed is growing. Is our generation going in? Are we consuming the seed or are we growing the fruit? I want to leave that challenge with you tonight, that our generation can grow the fruit instead of eat the seed. May God bless.